Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors.
Hello, and welcome to Travel Medicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Hey-o, Dr. Santosh here, pediatric infectious disease doc and a researcher.
And Santosh, I'm not going to write you a love song because you asked for it. Instead.
Are you bringing our listeners in like behind the curtain to show them a little bit behind? Yeah, we were... Dear listeners, we were talking about Sarah Bareilles' love song. I didn't realize how insane the lyrics were, and Dr. Josh just kind of rolled with it.
Well, then there's also, we also covered Hootie and the Blowfish.
We did.
Sting and the Police. There's a lot of problematic song lyrics that exist.
There are. And like, with like catchy tunes and beats and stuff, then lyrics that have no business being in like such, like kind of what are supposed to be like frivolous, cheesy, useless songs, but like, oh man,
like we don't understand the words coming out your mouth.
Yeah, we
but
do
it,
not.
It was a nice stroll down memory lane.
It was,
and as long as we were thinking of nostalgia-y things. Mm-hmm. Which, the return of X-Men 97, another topic of pre-recording conversation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So a brand new cartoon that, from everything you told me, takes off where the 90s X-Men comic ended with Graduation Day.
So, yeah, we're going back deep into our nostalgia and our feels, and I figured as long as we were doing that... It got me thinking about childish insults. And what was your go-to zinger as a kid?
Oh, my go-to zinger. I mean, yeah, I was the older brother and sometimes took out my, you know, the bullying at school would like kind of carry over at home. And until he got bigger than me, the stop hitting yourself, that one would work. Oh, the you're stupid, you know, and then yeah, your face stupid, and then it would devolve from there, like, oh, your head is stupid, you know, like, and it would keep going.
See, my brother and I had a wonderful back and forth exchange that, regardless of where it began,
Okay.
We got the traditional ones out of the way early. The I'm rubber, you're glue.
Yes.
Classic. Your mom. Also good. Less helpful when it's a sibling because it's also your mom.
It is. Yeah. I got yelled at by my mom about your mom. Because in Hinduism, you know, it's like very be respectful because that's your, you know, that's your parent and they're like God and that kind of a thing.
I think at the end of the day,
yes,
the one that I would always reach for when I was just out of ideas was the ever popular, oh yeah, well, so's your face.
Oh, yeah, so's your face always works.
But it got me thinking, we haven't done an episode on medicine of your face. Like, not your face.
Yeah, we've not gotten into your face.
So...
Or your face.
So that is our very roundabout way of saying that this episode, listening audience, is all about your face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm looking at you. So's
through,
your
through
face.
The microphone.
So's your face. So let's get into one of the first things that we talk about when we're looking at your face, which is your smile.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wasn't expecting it to take a positive turn, were you?
I absolutely love talking about smiles, all of the wonderful things that it conveys. I have, as many young people have, maybe I'm the only one, but I don't know. I've practiced a smile in a mirror to get like just the right type of smile going, the right crinkling of the eyes and how to curve my lips and stuff.
So you talk about crinkling your eyes. That's already a very specific type of smile. So we're going to talk about the gold standard of smiles. And yes, there is one. And Ooh. Then we're going to talk about the different kinds of smiles that spin out of that.
Okay, cool.
So our gold standard smile is called the Duchenne smile. Now it does share a name with the guy who discovered Duchenne's muscular dystrophy.
Okay.
It's because he was very invested in learning about facial reactions and facial muscles to the point that he invented a small little electroshock box that he would hook up to people and crank up the juice to see what kind of muscles would contract when you stimulated them with electricity.
This isn't like type of shocking. These were small electric potentials that you could pass over.
No,
the
this was the 1800s. They were absolutely the kind of shocks you would feel. But it did lead to a lot of research that told us, these are the facial muscles and here's how they contract and work in concert with each other. So the Duchenne smile is known as the smile of genuine enjoyment. It involves the mouth, the cheeks, and here's the important part, the eyes, the orbicularis oculi muscles, the one that give you the little wrinkles at the corner. It's the ones where your whole face lights up. And
the joyful one.
Now that we've said here's the gold standard of smile, let's talk about some of the others. So your smile type is formed after your facial muscles have identified a pattern.
I do want to mention about the people who live longer with the smiling. That was published in 2010. The researchers actually looked at baseball cards from 1952 and then found out how long the baseball players lived and compared them with their smiles. So it may just apply to baseball players.
Smile type, that your unique smile is formed after your facial muscles have kind of identified a pattern. So remember when your mom told you growing up that your face would freeze like that?
Well, she
wasn't wrong. It's that your face learns the kind of way that you like to smile, and it's very difficult to smile like somebody else. You can only smile like you. If you keep making faces like that, it will freeze. according to researchers, there are three different types of smiles from a physiologic standpoint. There's 10 kinds of emotional smiles, and then we start getting into BuzzFeed lists. So I'm going to keep it as scientific as possible.
Okay.
we have the cuspid smile, the commissure smile, and the complex smile.
Okay.
So it's estimated that about a third of the population has a cuspid smile. That's like a diamond shape. To do this, your levator labii have to be dominant since they move first to expose the cuspid teeth in your mouth. So your upper lip kind of pulls back, shows those top teeth.
Yeah, yeah. The cuspids are they're not the very, very front teeth, right? And they're not the canines, which are like the sharp ones. They're kind of in the middle. Or are they ones that are a little bit further towards the back?
So the cuspid, you show mostly your upper teeth and parts of your gums. And
got
if
it,
the
okay.
corners of your mouth move after pulling your lips up and out when smiling.
Okay.
So I really wish I could see how many of our listeners are now staring into their mirror to be like, all right, where are my lips going?
I'm actually imagining people like, you know, on their evening walks or something listening to us, and they just like they're starting to contort their faces, and someone is walking by the opposite way and just kind of like, the hell is... Do I need to call 911? Is that person having a stroke?
So a couple examples of celebrities with the cuspid smile are Angelina Jolie, mm-hmm. Jennifer Aniston, Tom Cruise. You look at them smiling, you're seeing a lot of upper teeth, gums. The lips pull up and out.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Uh-huh. The next type is the commissure smile. Now that's...
No, wait. Josh. Commissure.
Your commissioner smile. Yeah. That's about okay. two-thirds. That's about two-thirds of the world's population. So more likely than not, most of you listening are probably having that kind of smile.
Okay.
And this is where it has like a little bow shape, where if you're struggling to picture this, think of Audrey Hepburn on the Breakfast at Tiffany's poster. So to have this smile, the corners of your mouth or the commissure between your upper and lower lips move up and out, pointing toward the corner of your ears. This is where you get the phrase grinning from ear to ear.
Yeah, the commissure is the corners of your mouth, essentially, where your top lip and bottom lip meet.
So you're mostly showing upper teeth, but no gums. So it's like that, say cheese, and you don't really get the gums in there.
Yeah, I gotcha. Okay.
Now, the rarest type of smile is complex, and only about 2% of the population has this. And the reason it's so rare is you have to have three different muscle groups work simultaneously when smiling. So you have the two muscles used in the cuspid and commissure, and then the lower lip will pull downward, and you get kind of a double chevron shape. So it's much broader. People with this smile show their upper and lower teeth. So think Marilyn Monroe or Julia Roberts.
Oh, God. Yeah. You see a full set of chompers with that one. Okay, gotcha. Okay.
So now look at all your friends smiling and be like, I know what kind of smile you have.
And, you know, on the buy, there's going to be tons and tons of variations on this that, and not everybody has the same kind of smile in all situations. It can change a little bit from, you know, if it's a sarcastic smile or if it's an authentic smile or a big, big joyous smile or anything. But this is kind of the, in general, the way your muscles actually fire in order to make the shape, the general shape of your smile. And unless there's something neurologic that changes, I guess, Josh, your face is kind of frozen like that by about adulthood.
So your baseline smile, if you're happy and you know it, really doesn't change all that much. Now, there are a couple what we'll call emotional smiles, and those use some different muscles, things like the dominant smile or a sneer, where those are asymmetrical. One side of your mouth goes up, the other stays in place or pulls downward. The lying smile, which is like the say cheese, but it doesn't affect your eyes. If the smile doesn't reach your eyes, meaning you don't see those crinkles, it's probably not a true emotional smile.
Yeah, and by the way, we are focusing in when it comes to the, you know, the emotional smiles and such. The ones that Dr. Josh listed, the three main type of smiles, we're talking about physiology. These others have a lot more cultural context. So right now we're talking about mostly Western countries, the United Kingdom, the United States, Canada. It can really vary if you go to the European continent, Asia, Africa, South America, Australia even. These others can mean different things depending on what they're supposed to convey, you know, and how people at large accept those smiles. As a, for instance, I'm sure you know, Josh, in Korea, if you go to Seoul, for instance, you shouldn't smile wide with your teeth because it's actually looked upon as condescension.
And if you've ever dealt with customer service representatives anywhere on earth, they all universally exhibit what's known as the Pan Am smile.
Oh, yeah. That's, hey! that's the how can I help you? That
how
one.
How can I help? In a Pan Am smile or a customer service smile, you're using extra effort to yank on your zygomatic major muscle. So yeah, that's the one that kind of pulls your lips back. The corners of the mouth are extra high, like the Joker, and more of the teeth may be exposed. And it's you know this isn't real, and I know this isn't real, but here we are.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about this as this episode goes on, but that has, even though it's quote-unquote fake, it does have an effect of calming and soothing and, you know, kind of getting the person who's there in the customer service position to relate to the person across the table. But yeah, we'll get into that in just a little bit about how the social cues actually work.
So now that we've kind of addressed some of those, let's talk about the studies behind the smiles. So you have, for example, there is a study that was done in Sweden called the facial feedback hypothesis. And that showed that a smile actually has the ability to initiate emotions in another person. You can make people smile just by smiling at them.
Yeah. It's pretty good. And it's kind of contagious, like a yawn. And by the way, it does hold true for other emotional expressions. We humans are very communal type of animals, by and large. So recognition of emotion in another person is very socially advantageous, and it's kind of evolved into ourselves and into our behavior for a really long time. But yes, a real genuine smile can be quite contagious.
So in this study, they examined the voluntary facial action technique, which is, I think, the best way to refer to a smile.
I love that.
I am about to initiate a voluntary facial action technique at you.
Okay.
So for those of you playing along at home, the zygomatic major muscle is used to smile. The corrugator supercilii muscle is used to frown.
Zygomatic is, it refers to actually the bone that's in your cheek, essentially.
This study examined the facial feedback hypothesis, having people smile or frown at each other and seeing what kind of responses and facial actions were created in response. And it usually results in a smile back. So, all right, smiling at somebody can make them smile at you or think you're weird. But really, what good, like, what's a smile doing for me outside of interactions? Maybe you're introverted. Maybe you're neurodivergent and smiles aren't, and you're not just casually smiling at people to elicit emotional responses. What can a smile do for you as we sit here and pitch using your facial features?
Sure.
Research has shown that you can actually smile the pain away.
Ooh,
and let's
okay.
talk about some of the ways. Now, smiling during running can make you more efficient.
Oh, okay, gosh. So not necessarily faster or quicker or anything, but using your energy better.
Yeah. So in this study, 24 club level runners, so people who are more than just a casual jog or power walk around the block, were asked to complete 4 6-minute running blocks on a treadmill. Each run was done during a single session, and you had a 2-minute rest between each bout of running.
Okay.
During the run, participants were told to smile. And again, when I say smile, I'm referring to a Duchenne smile where it affects your eyes as well.
Got the big like happiest smile you can smile, which is real, not a fake rictus smile.
So okay. They were either smiling, frowning, which they were told in order to frown, they told runners to mimic your own facial expression during intense running. Like when you are struggling up a hill, the face that you normally make, make that face.
Josh, how in an audio medium do we properly, was that pretty good? Like how that to was, convey
that? Yeah, I liked it. I liked
okay,
it.
Good. Just making sure.
So participants... So participants either smiled, frowned, attempted to consciously relax their hands and upper body, or adopted their normal focus of attention. So neutral running face.
Resting running face.
resting running face. Now, my favorite is when they said, we want you to attempt to consciously relax your body, you know, not necessarily smile one way or the other. Imagine you're holding a crisp, but trying not to break it, which is how I learned to do running back in the day, which is what I call the imaginary cookie method, which is hold your hands out in front of you, grip them around a chocolate chip cookie, and as you take each stride forward, you're bringing one cookie up to your mouth, biting it, then bringing it back to your waist, reaching towards your pocket where presumably you have other imaginary cookies.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. We are in England with this study, by the way, which is why they use the words crisp. Not in England, but in Northern Ireland in the United Kingdom. But yeah, why they said crisp instead of chips.
Listen, I just like holding food in my hands while I run.
You do. It's the finger, thumb, forefinger grip. And then, just up to your mouth to pocket. Mouth pocket. Absolutely.
Mouth pocket.
No, to your mouth, to your pocket.
During each run, the participants had to smile, frown, attempt to consciously relax, or neutral running face. At the end of this, the key finding was the participants used the least amount of energy and ran the most efficiently while smiling. They were 2.8% more economical when smiling than frowning, and 2.2% more economical compared to just normal thoughts.
Oh, nice. Okay. So this is a little bit like... When I don't know if folks who listen to us have also watched the Mythbusters back in the day, but there was a really wonderful, fun experiment where the crew attempted to swear the pain away. They used pain by dunking their hand in ice cold water, and they were asked to cuss and scream and shout out swear words as much as possible. But this is kind of like a positive way of like kind of inducing some dopamine and stuff in order to get the pain down. It's kind of nice.
So next time you're trying to force your way through a run,
yeah,
smile and it will literally make the run go faster because you will be more efficiently running.
It will. I will say that is a helpful tip for any kind of grueling exercise, that, you know, give yourself a little smile, even if it feels fake or forced or whatever it is, there is a little bit of rush of dopamine. Not entirely proven. Like you said, participants were about 2.8% more economical when smiling than frowning. So this wasn't a massive jump. But it will add to your comfort when trying to get through a tough bout of exercise.
Not to mention, if you're smiling when running and making eye contact with people on the run, you can also be inducing emotions in them from that facial feedback hypothesis. So you're making yourself a more efficient runner and manipulating others' emotions. And really, What's not to like about that?
Oh, we're going to get people punched.
For smiling? Yeah. Hey, buddy, are you smiling at me?
Am I funny to you?
When you're smiling, the whole world apparently wants to punch you. No. But you mentioned the Mythbusters cursing to relieve pain. Okay. Smiling doesn't just help relieve kind of the self-induced pain of exercise. It can lessen the perceived pain of unpleasant situations.
Okay.
So another study was done during shots or vaccinations.
Oh, I thought you meant
getting
bourbon,
shot.
Gin, you know.
Well, I mean, maybe that too, but
yeah.
So probing each time point revealed the strongest effect to be at the moment of needle injection, where you had one group who had to do a true Duchenne smile, involving the eyes, thinking happy thoughts, and another group grimaced, which is that kind of baring your teeth like, you can see my face,
see
my skull, but not in a happy way.
Yeah.
and truthfully, and then they also had a neutral group, and if you did a Duchenne smile or a grimace, which is like the angry smile, those people reported 40% less pain from a needle injection than just a neutral-faced group who had a blank stare.
Ooh, okay, gotcha. All right.
So, and this was done with repeated measure ANOVA, or analysis of variance, which showed difference between conditions for both the heart rate. And in post-hoc analyses, the Duchenne smile group showed significantly lower heart rates, which is how they measured kind of responsive pain, because pain can be very subjective.
That's true.
So by looking at your heart rate in response to this painful situation, the Duchenne smile group had lower heart rates than neutral, with a few extra benefits found, and smiling and grimacing can improve subjective needle pain experiences, but the Duchenne smile may be better suited for blunting that stress-induced response. So you can trick your own body into being like, well, I'm smiling, I must like it.
Exactly right. It's a good way to do it. Josh, I will encourage everyone to please look at the, if you're able to get the PDF of the study by Dr. Sarah Pressman and Amanda Acevedo, as well as Catherine Hammond and Tara L. Craft-Feel. It's called Smile or Grimace to the Pain? The Effects of Experimentally Manipulated Facial Expressions. Josh, they had to have an objective way of getting people to smile. So they used
puppies. Puppies.
No, they used chopsticks. So in the neutral condition, participants held the tip of the pair of disposable wooden chopsticks loosely between their front teeth. So you just kind of get an type of look, like
I'm a walrus.
The non-Duchenne smile, they held the tip of the chopsticks between their teeth, but like bit down. And then for the Duchenne smile, they held the chopsticks lengthwise between their teeth and pushed the chopsticks back against their cheeks. So it would activate the zygomaticus major and orbicularis oculi. So in the grimace, they were asked to do the same thing, but they had to chop down hard on the chopsticks. The pictures are absolutely breathtaking for the model that was taken using all of the expressions on here. And it's fantastic.
So now that we've got you very introspective or self-conscious about what kind of smile you have, if you're rare or medium or well done, grimace, if you do these, now let's talk about what happens when you're lacking one of the key features of that smile, which is of course the bones that grow out of your face, your teeth.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think I'm like a commissure smile. I feel like I'm more like that.
I'm more of a cuspid. I do show a touch of my gums. I don't have complex.
Okay.
So you see my upper teeth, a little bit of my gums. I did practice smiling in the mirror before recording this episode, just in case anybody walked by and saw me in front of the mic.
Yeah, as we all know, Dr. Josh likes to record his podcasts in like the most open public places possible. So No.
So let's talk now about dentures.
Ooh, oh. So we're getting even like further into your face.
Yeah. All the way up in your face.
All the way up in your face and up in your grill.
So let's talk about dentures. Dentures have been made as far back as the 6th century BC, when the most skilled manufacturers were the ancient Etruscans, who were making false teeth with gold bridge work.
Bridge work. Sorry. For some stupid reason, I was like, were they carving gold out of bridges? And then... Okay, sorry.
So depending on the size of the gap, they would make a series of gold hoops. Okay. The outer ones would fit around the nearest sound teeth.
Okay, the ones that were intact.
And then the rest of those gold hoops would be filled with artificial teeth from ivory or bone, and it would be riveted in place with a gold pin. So these were secure enough to eat with. And have been found back as far as the 6th century BC. So the Etruscans were the original, you know, like fancy grills.
Wow. So this is like our modern hip hop artists have nothing on these folks.
No, this is before even Rome. This is ancient Italians were showing up the diamond grills that you see today.
Nice.
Now, and that's pretty much how dentures were made until the 18th century. And now, early attempts to create false teeth mostly involved using ivory. So dentists would carve teeth out of a single piece of ivory and then connect them with wire springs to make them articulate. And as it got more sophisticated, you would rivet artificial teeth to a plate made of ox bone or hippo ivory. One of the most famous, if I had to ask you, who's the most famous person you can think of from history who wore dentures?
I usually think of George Washington here in the United States, but was there anybody more?
No, that's in the US, that's the one. Now, okay. What does childhood you remember about George Washington's teeth?
Oh, we had weird ones. As far as I remember, I was told they were made out of wood, which didn't sound right because those would just like kind of rot over time, bathed in saliva and whatnot.
Yeah, Washington didn't have wooden teeth. He had this kind of denture from like hippo bone, and then there were hippo teeth in there. There were slave teeth in there. One or two might have been wood. Like Washington had a pretty busted grill.
Gotcha. Okay. He didn't get the fancy 6th century Etruscan golden hoops.
Yeah, there was no Etruscan design. This was, you know, homespun American frontier.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
lumberjack hippo teeth.
I don't know that anywhere in history has been said the phrase lumberjack hippo teeth. That's got to be, like, you know, if the universe had to roll the dice on that, I would say that was one of one.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever heard of Waterloo teeth?
Like the Battle of Waterloo?
So for most of the 1800s, prepare to be horrified.
Okay. All right.
Dentures were made from what are called Waterloo teeth. And why are they called Waterloo teeth? Uh-huh. Well, they were scavenged teeth from soldiers who died during the Battle of Waterloo in 1815.
Oh no. Oh dear. Okay. Well, I mean, teeth don't really die after the person dies, and the enamel is so hard, it'll last for a long time. So I guess you wouldn't want them to go to waste.
So the night of 18th of June, 1815, after 23 years of war in Europe, Napoleon faced the combined might of England, Holland, and Prussia at Waterloo.
Okay.
By the evening, the battle was over, the French were defeated, and 50,000 men lay dead or wounded on the battlefield.
Oh, dear. Okay.
One group of people were celebrating this high number of casualties, and those were the dentists, who were about to benefit from the Great Tooth Bonanza.
Do you have to call it that?
Yes.
Yes. Oh,
contractually obligated.
Oh, dear.
So scavengers would raid the battlefield after battles, stripping the dead of everything of value. Dentists would then buy. So in the early part of the 19th century,
yeah,
people with a lot of money but very few teeth were prepared to pay enormous sums for a good set of dentures.
Oh,
and
wow.
The best were made with real human teeth at the front.
Okay. So this is, it's a little bit like how, you know, there was certain hair that was prized for wigs and this kind of a thing, only like way more disgusting.
The supply and demand thing here. And the demand for secondhand incisors far, far outstripped the supply. And until then, wars had been used to help make up the shortfall here and there. But with that level of casualty, the windfall from Waterloo provided enough teeth to ship supplies all around Europe, even across the Atlantic. Washington probably had some Waterloo teeth in his dentures.
Wow. Okay.
So the scale of it was different. Yeah. Like, this is not a new thing, looting teeth from a battlefield.
Got it.
But the flood of teeth onto the market was so huge that it actually changed the name. So dentures from secondhand teeth, already a decent euphemism.
Yeah. Pretty good, yeah.
Acquired the name Waterloo teeth. So dentists would advertise their dentures as Waterloo ivory, and would claim the teeth came from young, healthy soldiers rather than the previous sources of executed criminals or older corpses. This turned into a patriotic thing. The idea that the teeth had once belonged to a brave young soldier had very high commercial appeal. You know, now you've got teeth from a fit and healthy young man killed by a cannonball, rather than molars plucked from the jaws of a disease-riddled corpse decaying in the grave.
Sure. Plus or minus grave robbing, I'm guessing. Okay. I get you where everything's coming from.
Like,
I don't...
which is worse? Burke and Hare,
yeah,
digging up bodies to sell to medical schools, maybe like 20 to 30 bodies plus the ones they killed.
Yeah, uh-huh, yes.
Over like a 15, 20 year period, or a battlefield so looted of teeth it changed the name of dentures in the world.
This is like the trolley problem of dentures. I hate both of these choices so much. This is so bad. Okay, well, I suppose that if those poor soldiers, you know, were off to die for their country anyway, I would have liked the donation to be a lot more like honorable and ethical. Perhaps they actually like signed a waiver or something saying, if I die, I'm okay with donating these, but I don't love this. I really don't.
So remember, prior to this, you'd have, you know, teeth from animal bones or ivory, and the result of that meant decay soon set in because you didn't have any enamel. So you get a rotten taste in the mouth, evil smelling breath, so the dentures would have to be replaced periodically.
Mm-hmm.
The fashion for fans, like, you know, when people hold a fan in front of their face,
right?
That came about because people were trying to hide bad teeth and stinking breath.
Oh, so it wasn't like coquettish, like a little kind of, oh, I'm trying to be cute and shy.
I mean, that may have been how it ended up, but it was started to hide these terrible, you know, rotting teeth in your mouth, which is why dentures made from human teeth were better because they looked better, resisted wear, and kept their color longer. But, you know, they're still going to decay and need replacing. So that means dentists needed a steady supply of human teeth.
Okay. All right.
What do you suppose the price for that would be?
Like a per tooth?
So in 1781,
okay,
we have records.
We have transactional records.
We have a like few transactional like records, yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
So this is before Waterloo teeth showed up on the market in 1815, okay?
Before they flooded the market, yes.
Yeah. In 1781, Paul Julian of Gerrard Street in London was charging half a guinea for a single artificial tooth and four times that for a human one.
Okay. I don't know how much a guinea is, but okay. I have a number in my mind. Okay.
Yeah. One guinea today would be about a pound, one pound in modern currency.
Okay, fair. Okay, gotcha, gotcha. All right.
So a half guinea would have been about 50
half a
cents.
Pound. Yeah, sure,
half a
like
pound,
50
a little
pence.
More. Yeah.
Okay, got it.
So that was for a single artificial tooth, and that means $2 for a single human tooth.
Got it.
Which
okay.
A row of artificial upper teeth cost £20.10.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's just the row of upper teeth, so 16 teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In 1783, there was an advertisement in a New York newspaper by a dentist offering 2 guineas each for sound teeth.
Right.
You have to be pretty desperate to sell your teeth, even if you're looking at, you know, £2 per tooth.
Sure, sure.
And this is why when the market was flooded with Waterloo teeth, the dentists were celebrating. And so were the resurrectionists because, you know, even if you dug up a body that was too far rotted to sell to the anatomists, you could still sell the teeth to the dentists and make a tidy sum.
Oh, okay, gosh. By the way, resurrectionist is the not so morbid name for grave robbers, for the people who are digging up corpses to sell to, by and large, medical schools and such.
All right, so you've got animal teeth, you have ivory, you have looted battlefield
bodies.
Teeth.
Uh-huh, yeah, okay.
A couple of people who took moral issues with this invented porcelain dentures.
Oh dear, that sounds a bit fragile.
Yeah, they were. They were too white, too brittle, and made a horrible grating noise.
Oh, no. You know that screech when you get when you like because you're putting plates out, right? And you mom says, you know, oh, get out the good china, and you get that, you know, clank clank like every time you.
But it was invented in 1837 when a London denture maker, Claudius Ashe, perfected them because he hated handling dead men's teeth. That's it.
So
that was the whole reason. Porcelain dentures were invented because this guy did not like touching corpse teeth.
Got it. I think that is as good a reason as I can possibly think of for inventing a new teeth with new materials. And I'm sure they weren't perfect, but I mean, at least it was an attempt.
They didn't stay in fashion terribly long, although you can still find a few in museums today. And they look lovely, but imagine trying to eat, like chomping down with not even the finest porcelain, just whatever happens to be handy, and you'd be breaking teeth left and right.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, but porcelain is not known for its durability.
Now, here's something I bet you didn't think about. Having dentures changes the shape of your jaw. It's not like having braces. It's not like having implants. And that's because when your teeth are removed or come out, your brain recognizes the roots of your teeth are no longer in your jawbone.
Okay.
And once the roots aren't there, it concludes, you don't need the jawbone. You're not keeping anything in it. So it will begin to reabsorb the minerals, the calcium, the phosphate, all there to use elsewhere in your body where it'll be more useful.
Oh, it actually like degrades the skeletal jawbone, the actual bone.
Yes.
Oh, dear. Okay,
which means
gotcha.
Long-term denture use has the of any sort has the side effect of shrinking your jawbone, which means after 10 or more years wearing dentures, you'll no longer have enough jawbone left even to keep dentures in your mouth. And this is known as facial collapse.
Oh, dear. So, I mean, I'm guessing you're like, it doesn't go away entirely, right? You just don't get, like a straight up, just a floppy jaw, but it's probably, you know, thin and gracile.
Well, have you ever looked at, say, a very elderly person's mouth where it's all gums?
Sure.
And like their face, it looks a little bit more puckered and pinched.
Yes, yes. I always thought that was just because there's no place for the lips to rest because there are no teeth there. But it has also to do with this kind of degradation?
Yeah. So the process can happen quickly with certain conditions. But if it's just a matter of you've lost your teeth, you have a lack of downward pressure.
Okay.
So the bone starts getting resorbed. And that's how you get that kind of what we think of as the weak-looking elderly chin. Because your jawbone's actually been resorbed. You don't have the jawbone that you did when you were younger.
Got it, got it. Okay, so it's the portion that used to be there to hold your teeth in place. But the bottom rim of the jaw and the actual sides that connect up to your, to the top of your skull to actually form the hinge of the jawbone, those are left intact. But that's why the elderly chin, quote unquote, with, who are chronic denture wearers, it looks kind of like they're sucking a lemon.
Yeah. Like you have that tang face where the upper lip hangs a little bit over, the chin retracts. And this is the result of long-term denture wearing or lack of bones. That's why dentists will leave even rotting teeth in the mouth unless they absolutely have to, because it essentially grounds your jaw and reminds your brain, hey, I'm still using this. Don't take it away.
Don't take it away. Okay, gotcha. It's somewhat akin to the bone loss that, for instance, astronauts suffer while being in space for long periods of time, because there is no downward pressure on the body. So the minerals in the bone that would usually support you start to get resorbed. Essentially, they get early osteoporosis.
So if you want to keep your jaw strong, that brings us to our next topic. Santosh, you've got a couple Gen Zers in the house.
Okay, yeah. They might be Gen Alpha. I don't, I can't remember.
Have they ever looked at you, put a finger to their lips, like they're shushing you, and then turns their head and traced their jawline?
Turn their head and trace their jawline.
So touch your index finger to your lips, then turn your head and trace your jawline from your earlobe to your chin.
To the tip of your... They've never done that in front of me, but that's like you see that in commercials, right? in, you know, like makeup commercials and stuff when they're trying to.
Well, that, and you see it in TikTok, and it's a trend called mewing.
What?
not meowing.
Not meowing.
Mewing.
By the way, I'm not incredulous because heaven knows, Josh, when we had so many memes and trends, you and I growing up even, because before there was TikTok and YouTube shorts and stuff, there was Vine and lots of other, you know, short form meme inducing things. So, you know, we had to live through planking. So... Mikey, I'm not incredulous.
Think about how everyone on Earth just knew to blow into the Nintendo cartridge controller. We didn't even have internet. Internet didn't exist, and we all just knew that. But that's neither here nor there. We're here to talk about mewing.
We're talking about mewing. Mew, like, you're making a sound like a baby kitten, though. Like, mew, like that?
No, no, you're not. It has nothing to do with that. It's originally invented by a Dr. Mew.
Oh, that's why. Okay, gotcha. All right.
I'm going to bet most of the TikTok crowd is unaware of this. So,
okay.
So for the people who are actually doing it on TikTok, we're going to give you a little history. For the people who have never heard of this, here's what the kids are doing, if not why.
Okay.
The heart of mewing is learning how to reposition your tongue to a new resting place with the thought or theory that over time your tongue position will change your overall facial features, specifically your jawline. It's meant to improve the aesthetic of the jaw, and and you do it by placing the tongue against the roof of the mouth while closing your lips and setting your teeth together.
Oh, okay. When you're trying to look confident and, you know, strong-willed, what your posture looks like in your face.
So the supposed benefits include a well-defined jawline and improved alignment of the chin and nose. So as the old people are having their jawbones retract, the young people are trying to do jaw-strengthening exercises.
these are like Kegels for your mouth.
Oh, that's a delightful way to think about it. Face Kegels.
Face Kegels. Oh, $1 million if we can change this phenomenon globally to face Kegels instead of mewing.
So for teachers who are getting frustrated with their students mewing them, there you go. That is a scathing critique. Enough with your face Kegels. We have classes to learn. So...
Okay.
You'll hear a whole host of things that mewing supposedly does. Gives you a well-defined jawline, can alleviate jaw pain, provide relief from snoring, maybe make your face look thinner. Dr. Mew was an orthodontist.
Okay.
And he's credited with popularizing the technique on the internet.
Okay. I mean, he was around in the 1970s. So he was talking about this, but this is, it's basically making like a retro kind of comeback kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, they took away his dental license because this guy was so hung up on, he's like, no, you just have to put your tongue and make this like pouty blue steel face, that he was a dentist who was criticizing traditional orthodontic treatments.
Sure.
And had a lot of unconventional beliefs and practices. And he's like, all right, fine. Take away my license. I will go and advertise this on the internet. So this is not someone to look up to.
Oh my God. He's a scam artist. Okay. Gotcha.
He is. But the thing is, while the purpose that people are using it for to strengthen the jawline is a whole bunch of bunk, the technique itself is not without merit and may provide some corrective techniques for children with tongue postures that have overbites or speech issues. And this was done in a study where your background tongue posture can play an important role in your anterior open bite or articulation disorders. So
speech therapy.
Yeah. So clinical assessment of tongue posture in kids is unreliable.
Okay. Trying to actually just suss it out with, okay, got it.
So one cross-sectional study included about 500 kids aged 3 to 7 years, 230 boys, 210 girls. All of them were examined by an orthodontist to look for an anterior open bite, an overbite. This was present in about 32 kids. The control group had 43 children just randomly selected from participants who didn't have this.
Okay.
And an orthodontist, an ear, nose, and throat specialist, and a speech therapist looked at their conditions, oral habits, and difficulty speaking, any articulation disorders. Then, using 3D studies using radiology studies by a radiologist, they looked at the tongue posture. And the control group with the anterior open bite group actually had a difference in tongue posture. And children who didn't have articulation disorders, the improper tongue posture occurred less frequently. So by teaching them to mew, you improve the tongue posture, you correct the articulation disorder. So it's good for the very young. Too young for TikTok.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. or at least they ought to be too young for TikTok. If kids that young are being shown TikTok, that's I'm going to go ahead and call that a parenting fail.
Now, many of the social media mewing advocates are teens. And here's the thing, kids, you young whippersnappers, your faces and your jawlines are actually likely to change naturally over the course of puberty. Mm-hmm. And that's probably what's happening. And it has nothing to do with this technique. So if you don't have a speech disorder or an overbite or some legitimate medical reason, mewing's really not doing anything for you. Any changes you think you're noticing are just your body's growing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same way that you have growth plates that are at the ends of your, arm bones and leg bones and everything, and they're stretching out and getting taller. There are different ways that flat bones like your skull and your jaw actually reshape as you grow. That's why you can kind of tell a kid face from a post-adolescent face. There's kind of clues to that, even, largely independent of culture and that kind of a thing. So yeah, kids, especially in your teenage years, your bones are pretty firm and strong. This kind of a thing isn't going to change anything. You're changing just because you're going to change.
And you're doing it based on something from a discredited dentist.
Yeah.
So, which brings us around to our last so's your face story.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Is this going to be as sad regarding the young'uns, or, will it restore hope to me?
No, this is sad regarding the old'uns.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Do you use a neti pot, Santosh?
I have tried this before. So this is basically sinus rinsing or sinus washing. I've tried this in the past in order to keep my sinuses and everything flush. I don't know if I'm doing it wrong or what, but I don't get much out of it.
So the theory behind it, and it actually dates back to Ayurvedic medicine, these nasal rinses, is you get something that looks like a tiny, adorable little teapot with a very long spout.
Yeah, which has the spout usually has a shape to fit right into your nostril.
And you fill it up with water, and then you tilt your head back and pour it into one nostril, and in everybody's favorite and gross party trick, the water flushes through and comes out the other nostril.
Yeah, so you tilt your head kind of up and to a side so that the water flushes up and over. And this practice, when done properly and everything, has been shown to reduce symptoms of nasal allergies like rhinosinusitis. And it is actually a very important part of regimens for people with chronic sinus disease in order to keep things clear. If it's done properly and you have the right anatomy for it, meaning you don't have, you know, any plugged up areas or deviated septums and things. It can be as effective with time as using intranasal steroids if it's done frequently enough and properly.
It can also kill you.
Oh, are you wandering into my field, into infectious diseases?
So over a decade ago,
yeah,
health officials linked U.S. deaths from a brain-eating amoeba named Negleria fowleri to nasal rinsing. More recently, we've started to see some of these deaths come back with a new microscopic parasite, acanthamoeba.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are both water amoebas.
And here's the part that, again, in case you weren't already horrified from all the other stuff we've discussed, officials in DC who cited a 2021 survey say about one third of U.S. adults incorrectly think tap water is free of bacteria and other microorganisms.
Uh-oh.
And two-thirds say tap water could be safely used for rinsing their sinuses. So these are people filling up their neti pots from their tap, which has bacteria levels low enough to pass inspection. We're not talking about lead pipes or things like that.
Right.
But this is not distilled water. There's still stuff living in it. Now, most of us have immune systems strong enough that taking the occasional sip from a water fountain or tap water is not going to cause any serious harm. But if you are pouring that water up into an area that we as physicians like to refer to as the zone of death.
Yeah.
That's a real thing. Uh-huh. I am not making that up. It's an area of the face.
For various reasons, not just what you put up your nose, but as a, for instance, if you pop a pimple in that area and you get an infection on your face, the blood vessels that feed that area and the veins that drain that area go back up through your brain, the cavernous sinuses. And so you can essentially get like a stroke from these kind of things. Yeah, so you have to be very careful around your nose and cheeks.
So the problem is not so much with the neti pots, as we've documented. There are some uses of them. Most people using it's probably not being terribly helpful or harmful. But if you are going to do it, the CDC recommends using boiled, sterile, or distilled water. Now, please note I said boiled past tense, not boiling.
Not boiling. Exactly. So, you know, you want to get it up to about 130 degrees Fahrenheit at least, and then allow it to cool. If you can get it all the way up to 212, it doesn't need to stay up there for too long. It can, you know, it can stay up at boiling temperatures for, 10 to 30 seconds. And then as you, you know, bring it down, as long as nothing else gets in there, you've basically nuked anything that could harm you in that thing. Bacteria, eukaryotic pathogens like amoeba. But yes, you can pass it through a pretty standard filter. You don't need anything fancy. The brand names like Brita or Pure, any of those filters work really, really well too. I do encourage getting the filters rather than using something like a bottled water or something like that, because bottled water, believe it or not, does not have ultra strict standards much further than tap water, unless it's, you know, actually like sterile saline. But yeah, you can use any one of those, either of those techniques, and the water that you use in your neti pot will be fine. You also should be cleaning the neti pot out regularly, Josh. So don't leave that sitting out on your counter and then fill it up with what you think is clean water. But yeah, this is thankfully a very rare incident, but it can happen if you're doing sinus washes regularly and you're not careful about cleaning your water source. That tap water is excellent to drink, not good to shove up your nose.
Yeah. So those are all the recent or fascinating stories I found about your face.
You got all up in my face, Josh. You had, like, seriously up in there.
So now you can go to bed thinking of brain-eating amoebas and Waterloo teeth and what kind of smile you have. So if you didn't learn something in this episode, I'll admit it, I'm a little disappointed.
Yeah. So just, I mean, to put everybody in kind of the right headspace here, we have made them self-conscious, given them nightmares about teeth from the dead, and then freaked them out about, you know, tap water going up their nose.
And if that doesn't give you a reason to smile, then golly, I don't know what will. So that's it for this week.
Yeah.
As always, we love to hear your comments, questions, and feedback. If you'd like to support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do that are in the show notes, along with links for further reading, because who doesn't want to learn more about this? And the show is produced by me with a lot of help from Dr. Santosh and friends. Like us, subscribe, recommend. We are on all the social medias. And until next time, as always, keep a song in your heart, soap on your hands, a shot in your arm, something in your mouth, because you don't want that jaw to fade away.
Yeah.
A spin on your globe. And when you've done all of those things, pick a place to go. Maybe Waterloo. Who knows if there's some teeth still buried out there.
It's entirely possible. Yeah.
I mean, or maybe it's all been, you know, looted. Who knows? And when you've done all that, happy travels.
Bye, everybody.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.